The Hour of the Time may be contacted at HOTT, that's H-O-T-T, P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, in the state of Arizona, 85925. Our phone number is 928-333-2942, and our website is www.hourofthetime.com. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of The Hour of the Time. I'm your host, Robert Houghton, and tonight we have a special guest on, Michael Cremo. And those of you that were at the conference last year will know that Michael was there and gave a fantastic presentation, and we're back to catch up with him. For those of you that don't know Michael, he's a research associate of the Bhaktivedanta Institute, specializing in the history and philosophy of science. He's a member of the World Archaeological Congress, the European Association of Archaeologists, the History of Science Society, and the Philosophy of Science Association. So, he's got a lot of interesting stuff to tell us tonight, and we'll be right back after this musical break. Folks, this one's for the Hour of the Time attendees. Came out to the conference last year in Arizona, latter part of September. You guys are so beautiful.
I'd seen it with my very eyes. What we were told was heaven all along. Words couldn't quite begin to say what it could do to you. Thank you.
Well, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You are indeed listening to the Hour of the Time here on the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network. I'm your host for this evening, Rob Houghton, and once in a while, it's nice to have a guest on that you've actually met face-to-face, and tonight, I've had the great pleasure of having Michael Cremo on the line with me. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Well, great to be with you, Rob, and all your listeners.
I was just on your website there earlier today, and I see you have a couple of pictures up from your visit down to our Hour of the Time conference last fall.
Well, that was a really great event. I was really honored to be invited. It was a real great venue out there in the high plains of the West. It was really a great event. I loved it.
And actually, several of our listeners will already be aware, but we're working on a DVD of Michael's presentation that he did at the Hour of the Time conference last year. James Jankowicz, the producer of the documentary on Bill Cooper, and also The Fourth World, the documentary about the Little Bear dig site on the same ranch that we're talking about here, had the opportunity to do an interview with Michael, and Ether Filmworks is working on that production as we speak. So hopefully that'll be out near the end of the winter here. Up here at the Canadian studio, Michael, if you were going to do any archaeological digging today, there's a few feet of snow here that we'd have to get through. So I think you made a good choice in making a decision to do a little tour through Arizona this time of year.
Right, yeah, I'll be giving a couple of lectures this weekend in Sedona, in Prescott, and in Tucson. And if any of your listeners are interested in the details, they could look at my website, mcremo.com, the section called Schedule. mcremo.com, the schedule section, if
okay.
You're interested in that.
So that's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, is it?
That's correct.
Okay. Wonderful. And I noticed there that you'll be heading off to Dubai as well after.
Well, there's a conference on ancient civilizations in Dubai. Some of the leading alternative history researchers in the world, like Graham Hancock and
okay.
Robert Bevall and a whole bunch of others, including myself, are going to be speaking at that conference February 12th through 13th in Dubai. Also, if anybody's heading out that way, I don't know if any of your listeners are heading out to Dubai, they could see the details of that conference on my website, the schedule section as well.
That's an expensive destination. Have you been to Dubai before?
Actually, I went last year
okay.
to the same conference, and it was pretty amazing. There's one big, huge shopping mall where they have an indoor ski slope in case anybody's missing the snow.
Well,
they can ski in Dubai.
I don't think that would be my first choice. I'd be leaving the snow behind this time of year for sure.
Yeah.
So anyhow, Michael, I guess let's just get started. Everybody's heard your biography there in the little first intro bit that I did. But how did you get started, and I guess why did you get started in this research into the ancient histories of man?
Well, that has to do with some experiences that I had when I was growing up. I grew up in a military family. My father was a military intelligence officer. So as a result of that, you know, our family lived in a lot of different places in the United States and abroad, like Europe and other places. And that experience sort of opened me up to different ways of looking at things. And also, you know, the fact that my father was an intelligence officer clued me into the idea that there's secret knowledge, there's knowledge that a lot of people aren't really aware of. So those experiences opened me up to new possibilities of looking at the world, looking at human history. So later I encountered the spiritual traditions of ancient India.
Okay.
And I was attracted to them, and I took up a system of yoga and meditation that was taught by one of the gurus from India, His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. And Through that experience, I also became interested in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India. And in particular, there's a group called the Puranas, or the Histories. And they speak of a very ancient human presence on this planet. According to most scientists today, human beings like us first came into existence about 150,000 years ago.
Okay.
And before that, we're told there were only more primitive ape-like human ancestors. But in these ancient books...
So the Darwinian think, it dictates that we're about 100,000 or 150,000 years old?
Yes.
Okay.
This is what the mainstream evolutionary theories that are taught in all the school systems tell us. But according to these ancient books of wisdom, humans have been present since the very beginnings of the history of life on Earth. In other words, we haven't just been here for 150,000 years, 100,000 years or so. We've been here for millions of years. And this idea is something that's found not only in the ancient wisdom traditions of India, but it's found in practically all the ancient wisdom traditions of the world. Whether we're talking about the Bible or the Quran or other traditions, they all pretty much say humans have been around since the beginning.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I thought if there's any truth to what these ancient wisdom traditions tell us about human origins and human antiquity, then there should be some physical evidence to back it up. So I started looking through the current textbooks of archaeology and anthropology, and of course I didn't find any such evidence there. You only find discoveries, facts, evidence that support the current evolutionary theories of human origins. But I decided to look beyond the textbooks. I decided to go back to the original scientific literature, the primary scientific literature. The original reports by original investigators published in the scientific literature. And when I did that, when I started looking through that original scientific literature from the time of Darwin all the way up to the present, I was very surprised to see that there were many scientists who had discovered evidence that humans like us have been present for millions of years on this planet. And these discoveries take the form of human bones, human artifacts, and human footprints, many, many millions of years old. So I was rather surprised to see.
How is it that all of this knowledge was able to just be thrown by the wayside then? You know, if the original scientists have included this information in their reports, how is it that the textbooks aren't reflecting this?
Well, there's a process of knowledge filtration that goes on in the world of science. That's what I call it, knowledge filtration.
Okay.
Whereby theories often determine what facts are accepted. Most people think that science works in the opposite way.
Right, that's what they lead us to believe.
They look first at the facts, and then they form their theories. But in practice, it often works another way. They have their theories, and their theories determine what facts are accepted and what facts are rejected. So here's how it works. You know, if there are reports of evidence that go along with the dominant theories, those evidences, those facts will pass through the knowledge filtering process, and they will make it into the textbooks. You'll see scientists talking about this evidence on television. If you go to the local museum, you'll see these artifacts, these discoveries. But if we have facts that radically contradict the current theories, they tend to get filtered out, which means you won't read about them in your textbooks. You won't hear scientists talking about them on the National Geographic specials and NOVA specials and the History Channel and things like that. And if you go to the local museum, you won't see these discoveries, although the discoveries may be there somewhere in the back rooms of the museums. So to give a short answer to your question, the reason why these reports are there in the original scientific literature and they're not found in the textbooks is because of knowledge filtering.
Now, does that happen? I mean, obviously, we see a lot of this. The artifacts that we're seeing, or I guess, are not the ones that you have seen in the past. Is that what you're getting at? Because I understand, because of all the research you've done, you have sort of a virtual backstage pass to some of these basement rooms and these museums and different archaeological dig sites and things, where you would have seen a lot of objects, artifacts, and enigmatic things that obviously myself as a member of the public wouldn't have had the opportunity to view.
That's right. For example, let's look at the California gold mine discoveries. You know, in the 19th century, gold was discovered in the mountains of California, the Sierra Nevada mountains, and miners went there to get the gold, and they were digging tunnels into the sides of mountains to get the gold out. So deep inside these tunnels in the solid rock, the miners were finding human skeletons and human artifacts, stone mortars and pestles, obsidian spear points, and things like that. And these discoveries came to the attention of Dr. J.D. Whitney, who was the chief government geologist of California. Mount Whitney is named after him.
Okay.
He was a very prominent scientist. So he began investigating these discoveries. He began collecting them, and he wrote a report about them that was published by Harvard University in the year 1880. And these discoveries of human bones and human artifacts were made in layers of solid rock that modern geologists tell us are over 50 million years old. That's 50 million years old. That's just astonishing that humans were present at that time, because the current textbooks tell us that humans only came into existence about 100,000, maybe 150,000 years ago. So even at the time Dr. Whitney was making these discoveries, some scientists were objecting to them. For example, there was a scientist named William Holmes, an anthropologist working at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington. And he said, well, if Dr. Whitney had understood the theory of human evolution, then he would not have published those discoveries. He would have known. In other words, he would have known the facts as he found them couldn't possibly be true because they contradicted the theory of evolution. And if those facts contradicted the theory, then they should not have been published. They should have just been ignored. And actually, that's what happened in the scientific world. They just started ignoring these discoveries because they contradicted the theory of evolution. However, some of the artifacts collected by Dr. Whitney are still in the collection of the Museum of Anthropology at the University of California at Berkeley. Now, a few years ago, there was a television producer from New York named Bill Cote. He learned about my work, and he wanted to include it in a documentary he was making for NBC called The Mysterious Origins of Man.
Okay, I have actually seen that, but yeah.
Yeah, so I sent him to that museum. He wanted to know, well, where are some of these discoveries? Where's something that we could possibly film? So I said, some of these artifacts from the California gold mines, these 50-million-year-old artifacts from the California gold mines, are still in the collection of this museum at the University of California at Berkeley. So he went there, but the museum officials just refused to allow him to film them. They wouldn't let him see them. Now, later I went back to that same museum myself. I'm a member of the World Archaeological Congress, which is the world's largest international organization of archaeologists. And I had proposed to present a report about these discoveries at one of their conferences. And my proposal to give such a report had been accepted by the World Archaeological Congress. So I was able to go to the director of the museum and say, well, I've proposed to give a report on these discoveries to a meeting of the World Archaeological Congress, and that proposal has been accepted, and I showed him a letter of acceptance. So on that basis, they allowed me to see the artifacts. They're not kept in the museum itself. They're kept in a storage building several miles from the museum. And every step of the way, I had to be accompanied by a staff member of the museum. But they did allow me to see them and photograph them, and I was able to give my report about these discoveries to a meeting of the World Archaeological Congress that was held in Washington, D.C. in the year 2005. So now, if you went to the museum, you would never see these things because they're not shown to the public. And there's not just one case like this. There are other cases from European museums where I've been able to get in and see things that the general public normally would never see or would never even be aware of.
Now, what would the agenda be behind that? I mean, I understand that, obviously every item that a museum has can't necessarily be put on display, but you think that there might be a room with, like I say, all these enigmatic items in it saying, you know what, we just haven't figured this one out yet because it doesn't fit in with our current theories, you know?
Well, that
you would,
would encourage
people.
That would be ideal, I think.
Yeah.
But they tend to think, well, you know, some people are of the opinion that, well, maybe they're hiding evidence that they know to be true, and they don't want it displayed because it would cause people to disbelieve in their theories. That's not necessarily how it works. In a lot of cases, they just think, well, something's got to be wrong with this evidence. The facts really can't be as they were reported by Dr. Whitney or Michael Cremo or whoever. You know, there's something wrong with these discoveries. Maybe we haven't been able to figure out exactly what it is, but they're of the opinion that these things couldn't possibly be true. So there's no sense in showing them. They're just some, as you say, enigmatic discoveries that belong in the storerooms. And but I think you're right. I think it would be good, for the museums to display these things and just say, well, there's some controversy about them. The original discoverers thought they were very, very ancient, far older than most theories now allow, and there are still some people today who believe that, and they're mysterious objects, but here they are. I think that would be, and probably they'd get a lot more people coming into the museums.
You would think so. it would encourage the skeptics to at least come and see for themselves and, then try like hell to make their own theories fit these objects, or
right.
Make these objects fit their theories, whatever the case may be.
I think that would be a very good thing for museums to do, is to, especially public tax-supported museums. I think the public tax-supported museum should be open to the whole range of points of view that are out there in the tax-paying public about these things. Yeah, there are many people who support the theory of evolution and the current theories, that's a fact, but there are also many people, including researchers, who don't support these theories. So I don't think a public tax-supported museum should just represent the views, even the majority view, of the scientific world in presenting evidence and exhibits and displays. I think they should be open to a whole variety of perspectives, whether it's the perspectives of, for example, the First Peoples, I guess you call them in Canada, Native Americans we call them in the United States. They have a whole perspective about the history of the country and the archaeological artifacts that are there. And yeah, then there are alternative researchers like myself who are investigating new theories of human origins and antiquity. So I think a public tax-supported museum should represent all the views neutrally. You know, they shouldn't just be favoring, you know, one perspective, one point of view. Now, if you have a private museum that's privately funded, then I think it has more right to just represent, you know, one perspective. For example, if the supporters of the theory of evolution wanted to have a private foundation that supported a private museum with their own funds that just wanted to represent their particular point of view, I think that would be okay. Just like if there were some Christian creationists who used their private money to set up a private foundation, have their own private museum that only represented their particular point of view, I think that would be all right. If I wanted to raise some money and set up a foundation to run a museum to just represent Michael Cremo's point of view, that would be okay.
I'd be first in line through the admission doors.
Well,
it would be wonderful.
A virtual museum on my website.
That's true, too.
But I think for, you know, the public tax-supported museums that are taking tax money from all the people, I think they have a duty to not be just representing one point of view. They should be open to all the points of view that are out there in the public. So that's, I stood up on the soapbox. And
well, I tend to agree with you on that one.
That.
For sure. And that, I mean, that's not to say that your work hasn't been warmly received by many mainstream archaeologists as well.
Well, that's a fact. I mean, some people think that I'm against science or something like that, but many people who support me think, well, that all scientists are opposed to these things, but that hasn't been my practical experience, because what I found in practice is that the world of science is not all of one stripe. You know, it's not monolithic. There are varieties of opinions, even among mainstream scientists, and some of them are actually open to considering alternative perspectives like mine. And it's scientists of this kind that have invited me to speak at many universities and scientific institutions and scientific conferences around the world. And among that group, there are some who actually agree with me. And in many cases, they are scientists who themselves have been victims of this knowledge filtering process that I've talked about.
Yeah.
For example, Virginia Steen McIntyre. You know, she's a geologist that I know. And when she was first beginning her career in geology, she was involved in dating an archaeological site in Mexico, at a place called Huayatlaco. And there, a team of American archaeologists had uncovered some human artifacts, and of course they wanted to know how old they were. So they called a team of geologists to the site. Virginia Steen McIntyre and some colleagues of hers were called to the site, and these geologists used four of the latest scientific methods to date the site, to give some idea of how old these artifacts were. And they came up with an age of about 250,000 years. So the archaeologists said, that's impossible. According to their theories, human beings capable of making the kind of artifacts that were found there did not exist 250,000 years ago. They hadn't evolved yet. They had not evolved yet. So the archaeologists refused to publish the age for the site given by their own hand-picked team of geologists. So Virginia Steen McIntyre and her colleagues were very upset by this. So they They independently published the age for the site, but when they did that, they experienced an extreme negative backlash from their colleagues in the scientific world. And as a result of this, Virginia Steen McIntyre found that her career as a geologist, which had been, you know, she'd been a rising star in her profession, but after she published this report, she suddenly found that her career was practically speaking finished because she had dared publish something that contradicted the theory of evolution. So sometimes, you know, there are these scientists who themselves have experienced this knowledge filtering process. And
it kind of makes you wonder why, you know, if your opinion is correct, that, or if a person's opinion is correct, let me correct that by saying that Darwin's theory of evolution is the way things happened and humans are indeed only 150,000 years old, why would you be in the least bit threatened by information that pointed in other directions? You know, just take the time and make it point in your direction if it's so easy to do. I just don't understand why these people are...
That would ideally be the way in which science works. Sometimes it doesn't work that way.
It's very protectionist, it seems.
Now, whatever one's opinions are about, you know, climate change and global warming are, I think everyone involved in that whole debate, whether they believe in global warming and climate change caused by humans or not, really thinks that what this group of scientists did, who were, you know, trying to manipulate the evidence, and there's this climate gate idea.
Exactly.
I think everybody admits that that was wrong, what they did. You know, trying to suppress evidence, trying to block publication of reports that disagreed with their theories and things like that. It's been a lot of people who know me and my work have kind of brought that whole climate gate controversy to my attention, saying, well, this appears to be exactly what you're talking about, that, you know, sometimes there's a bit of knowledge filtering that goes on. There are attempts to suppress evidence, to discredit those who are going against the favored theories, who won't, you know, join the team, so to speak. So it's something that does go on. Maybe in an ideal world it wouldn't go on, but, you know, people do have interests, they do have egos, so you do get these things happening. So it's just, I guess, human nature in one sense. And it often happens as well that when a group becomes dominant, it wants, somehow or other, it may want to exclude other voices, which I think is unhealthy. I think you pointed out what you suggested is the real way to go, but often it doesn't happen like that. People who get power, whether it's political power, economic power, or intellectual power, or military power, once they get in a position of dominance, they usually don't want to give up that position or share it with anybody.
Certainly so, yep.
It's just human nature in one sense, I think. But it would be better, especially in... Yeah, we like to think that we live in free democratic societies. So I think in free democratic societies, I think there's got to be a little more toleration of some diversity of opinion about these things. Now, like the situation at the present moment in the United States and most other countries that I know of is that the supporters of the Darwinian theory of evolution have an absolute monopoly in the education systems. They will not allow any other ideas to be represented, only their ideas. And if anybody tries to introduce any alternative perspectives, then they find themselves excluded. Because, and sometimes it happens that people, you know, the people of a state, of a city, of a county, they pass some laws in their state, county, or region to try to get some diversity of opinion in the education system on this question of human origins, human antiquity, evolution, or whatever. And what they find is that the supporters of the current theories will then go to the national courts in America, the federal courts in Canada, maybe it's the, I don't know exactly what they call it up there, national courts, and they'll convince, you know, one or two judges that to support them, and then those one or two judges, those handful of judges, will overturn the opinion of the people, and they'll just keep supporting this idea that only one idea should be taught in the nation's school systems. You know, the Darwinian theory of evolution, that's it. Now, I really don't mind if somebody's a supporter of the theory of evolution. I believe in intellectual freedom. I believe people, scientists included, should believe whatever they want about the origin of life in the universe. If the theory of evolution makes sense to an individual scientist, then that's what he should support. That's how he should do his research. But here's what I would say. I would say that doesn't give you a right to exclude other points of view from the education system and the scientific institutions.
That's my only point. Yeah. Have you by chance seen that the Ben Stein movie Expelled?
Oh, I did see that.
So,
yes,
there's another
really good points there.
A grand example of the knowledge filtration and the blackballing of certain scientists and professors who chose to disagree with the theory of evolution. And one would think that, you know, they would want to encourage dialogue, but in fact, Ben's movie kind of exposes the fact that dialogue is certainly one-sided, as we're talking about today, too.
Yeah, I'm prepared to admit that today the majority of scientists support the theory of evolution. That's a fact. But it's also a fact that there are some, a minority at the present moment, who don't accept that idea. And I think their ideas should be represented in the textbooks. And I think the proper solution would be, okay, give 95% of the textbook pages in biology to the theory of evolution. But the other idea should also be neutrally presented. That, yes, today most scientists think the theory of evolution is true, so that's what you're going to find in this textbook. But there are some scientists, some researchers who do not accept that idea. And here's what they have to say, neutrally, objective. Here's what their objections are. Here's the evidence that they use to support their ideas. And then just let the students make up their own minds about these things. But that's not what's happening today. All you get is one point of view. And even though there are other points of view, and people do want to see them represented, the supporters of the current theory of evolution in the scientific world have used their power, they've used their influence with the governments and the courts and the education ministries to exclude other ideas. Now, I think it's really, in one sense, a little bit hypocritical, because usually in these same textbooks you always find the story of Galileo. Galileo, several centuries ago, he had some ideas about, you know, the solar system and everything that were different than the dominant ideas. And then the church, because it had influence over the governments at that time, you know, the church used its influence with the government to suppress his ideas, to exclude them. And this is given, you know, in all these textbooks as a classic example of what should not happen. But now that, you know, the scientists are the ones with the influence over government, the majority of scientists who support the theory of evolution are using their influence with government and the courts to exclude the ideas of researchers who disagree with them.
Now, if you
the same thing all over again. It's a sad history that when you're in the minority, when you're the victim of the suppression and the knowledge filtering, you want your ideas to be represented. But when you're in power and you're the one in control, then you feel it's okay, you know, to do that.
So if you were to sit down in a room with some of these proponents of Darwinian theory and bring with you your favorite object that you've handled over the years that could perhaps convince them to at least delve in a bit deeper into your theories on the state of things, what would your favorite object be?
Well, to me, it's not any one favorite object. With me, it's the huge mass of evidence. There are hundreds of reports of human bones, human artifacts, and human footprints that go back many millions of years that contradict the current theory. That is, for me, the most important thing. Not that there's one or two.
So we would be taking cases, several transport
among
trucks.
Cases, among those good cases, and it's also the fact that it's possible to demonstrate not only that these discoveries are there, but it's also possible to demonstrate how they have been rejected simply because they contradict dominant theories. But that said, I mean, I'm speaking what I really think here. I think it isn't that there's just one, really, really surprising, interesting case. It's the fact that there's so many of them. But among them, I have to say, I really do like the California gold mine discoveries. To me, they are just, I mean, it's almost impossible to really refute them or dispute them. They're discoveries that came to the attention of one of the leading scientists in America. He carefully investigated the discoveries. He considered all possible objections to them. His report about them was published by Harvard University. I mean, it was a really great, great case. But it was simply rejected because it contradicted. These discoveries were rejected simply because they contradicted the dominant theory of human evolution. That it's an amazing case. Now, if there were just one case like that, you could dismiss it, say, well, but there's so many cases on the other side. But again, what I think is really significant is that there's not just one case like this. There are many, many, many cases.
Is there a certain museum anywhere on the face of the planet that some of these objects are indeed on display, where public could walk in and actually see some of these things?
Well, a few years ago, there was a gentleman in Austria named Klaus Dohna.
Okay.
And he put together a display of anomalous artifacts that he got on loan from private collectors and private museums and some public museums from all parts of the world. And he put together an exhibition of them in Vienna, Austria, a few years ago. And he held a conference in connection with the opening of the exhibit. Of course, he invited me, among others, to speak at that conference. And I believe he made a DVD of the exhibits and some of the conference lectures. So that gentleman's name was Klaus Dohna, K-L-A-U-S, D-O-N-A.
Okay.
And maybe by... You know, that was, I think, a really extraordinary event. It was a temporary exhibit, and all the artifacts had to be returned to the original sources. After that, it was a pretty amazing event. It's the only thing that I know. The only event that I know of where a lot of these things would have been available for the public to see. Now, I think because he made a DVD of them, members of the public are still able to see them. But it was a rather unique event. You know, that was a pretty amazing event.
So everything we've spoken about tonight basically can be read about further in your book, Forbidden Archaeology, that you co-authored with Richard L. Thompson?
That's correct. That book is 900 pages long. It contains complete documentation of all of the discoveries. Now, for those who are maybe put off by a 900-page book, we also brought out that book in a shorter edition called The Hidden History of the Human Race, which is about 300 pages long. And it contains all the same cases, but it's just done in a more simple way. For those who want chapter and verse, the whole nine yards, the complete documentation, they should go for the book Forbidden Archaeology. For those who want a more quick overview of all the same discoveries, they might want to pick up The Hidden History of the Human Race.
And even if you have either of those books, folks, I would definitely suggest checking Michael out if you get the chance. In you said it was Sedona, Tucson, and what?
Prescott.
Because he has a wonderful PowerPoint presentation as well that goes along with it. And you can see some of these artifacts in the presentation. Obviously, you can go to mcremo.com as well and check out some of the images in the virtual museum that he has there. But definitely worth seeing Mike alive, too. So, what do we have left here? We got about 7 minutes left to the top of the hour, Michael. I guess we haven't really spoken about human devolution much yet today.
Well, that's, after people read my book, Forbidden Archaeology, or the abridged version, The Hidden History of the Human Race, they began asking me a question. They began asking me, well, okay, you have all of this evidence that contradicts the current theory of human evolution. Then where did human beings come from? What's your idea about that? What's your alternative to the Darwinian theory of evolution? So to answer that question, I wrote a book called Human Devolution, A Vedic Alternative to Darwin's Theory. And I called it a Vedic alternative because my alternative ideas are inspired, by my studies in the ancient Vedic wisdom tradition of India. So basically what I proposed in this book was, before we even ask the question, where did human beings come from, we should first ask the question, what is a human being?
Okay.
Now, today, many scientists are going to say that a human being or any other living thing is just a complex organization of chemicals, a complex organization of the material elements, and that's all there is to it. And what we call consciousness and mind and all that is just a temporary byproduct of bioelectrical activity in the brain. In other words, when you organize matter in a sufficiently complex way, you get consciousness and mind and all that, but only temporarily and only in association with this complex organization of matter in the brain. And when you disorganize that matter, then no more consciousness, no more mind, nothing like that. So under this point of view, a human being is simply a complex organization of material elements, and that's all there is to it. But what I'm proposing is something different, that it's consciousness that is primary, it's consciousness that is always existing, and under certain circumstances, consciousness can be temporarily covered by matter. So what I'm proposing is that as conscious beings, as conscious human beings, we did not evolve up from matter. Rather, we have devolved or come down from a level of pure consciousness. And now that pure consciousness has been covered by matter. And that's what I mean by devolution.
Okay.
The process by which a pure conscious self becomes covered by the lower elements of mind and matter. And under this view, our main purpose in human life should be to restore consciousness to its original pure state. In other words, there's a process of the evolution of consciousness by which consciousness can be restored to its original pure state. So that's what that book, Human Devolution, is about, showing that there is a conscious self that can exist apart from matter, apart from the body. And there's lots of scientific evidence for this in the form of medical studies, of out-of-body experiences, psychiatric studies of past life memories, and a whole lot else.
There's a whole lot of interesting work going on in quantum physics as well that is tending to point towards the fact that some of these topics that you discuss are in fact provable by science, although we haven't been able to yet. So it's interesting that all of that's developing, you know, in the last decade or so. We're learning a lot more about the physical universe, which brings up more questions about the spiritual and the spiritual one, I guess.
Yeah, and many researchers in quantum physics see a huge role for consciousness in it. They believe that consciousness is a primary feature of reality, which is what I'm saying in another way.
Mm-hmm.
It's consciousness that's primary. It's consciousness that's always existing. And under certain circumstances, this conscious self can be covered over and limited by matter. That's the main point I was trying to get across in that book, Human Devolution. We don't evolve up from matter. Rather, we devolve or come down from a level of pure consciousness.
So with the, you call it a Vedic alternative to Darwin's theory, do you go into other religions as well?
Yes, I do. I have a chapter in the book which is a cross-cultural study of cosmologies.
Okay.
Where I investigate the cosmologies of about 25 different cultures and religious traditions down through history and different parts of the world. And what I find is they all have a lot in common. They all tend to say that a human being is not just a combination of matter, but a combination of three things: matter, mind, and consciousness, or spirit, if you like that word. None of the great wisdom traditions of the world, none of the great cultures of the world believe that humans have come simply by a process of material evolution. They all tend to say we came from some higher level of reality. That's what our real origins is, not matter, but some higher spiritual or consciousness-based level of reality to which we're meant to return. So, yes, I don't think that the Vedic tradition has a monopoly on truth. I don't think I have a monopoly on truth. I think truth is to be found in many different places, in many different wisdom traditions. And, you know, it's like gold. I'm prepared to recognize gold wherever I see it. Now, you may have different gold coins stamped with the symbols of different nations, but if it's gold, it's gold. It doesn't matter what symbol is stamped on it. It doesn't matter what you call it. So I think it's the same with spirituality. I think it's to be found in many different religious traditions, which I honor and respect. I think exclusive claims to truth are one of the big problems that's there in the world today that causes a lot of unnecessary conflict and strife.
Absolutely, especially when you see some of the, you know, when you read the book and you study some of these traditions, and you see that a lot of them do dovetail into certain universal truths, you know.
I think that's the important thing. The universal truths are what are important, and then how they're expressed, you know, in a particular tradition, it may attract one person or another. But I respect the choices that different people make regarding, you know, what their spirituality is, what their religion is, what their culture is. I respect that, just as long as they're not causing needless pain and suffering to others, you know, and that they also respect the choices that others have made. I think that's what's really important.
Absolutely. And that sort of brings us up almost here to the top of the hour. And once again, back to Arizona, where I had the opportunity to stroll with Michael through the Little Bear dig site. And here's another site, the Hopi Indian dig site from, we're estimating between 400 and 800 A.D. And in this dig site, you'll see a grand room where there are four pits that represented the four previous worlds that had existed to the Hopi Indians, and that these traditions were passed down in orally over the years. And these four different worlds speak of four different ages that existed before, and you'll see parallels of maybe different numbers of ages and things. But even with these Hopi Indians, you know, as recent as 1,000 years ago, we can see these traditions being this ancient history of man idea is right there in the earth before us. So you can see the four previous worlds that were destroyed, each by different tragedy, and you can see these grand cycles that the Hopi Indians were talking about. So,
yes, absolutely. I really think they had some insight that there are different levels of reality, that time goes in cycles, that one age follows another, that as humans we make progress through different levels of reality. They were right on as far as I'm concerned.
Well, it's certainly right now an interesting age to be alive. Seem to be rediscovering some of these things. Lucky enough to be living at the present that I was able to participate in some of this learning as well. So I really appreciate having you on the program tonight, Michael. It's wonderful.
Well, great to be on the show.
Great to talk to you again.
Shows like this are very important for getting these ideas out and getting feedback from the listeners and everything like that.
Absolutely. Well, we'd love to have you back on maybe after you get back from Dubai, and you can give us an update on how that conference went.
I'd love to do that.
Okay, wonderful. Well, that's it for tonight, folks. Thank you for tuning into the Hour of the Time. You can check out our website at www.hourofthetime.com, and please go and check out Michael Cremo's website, wonderful website full of lots of cool stuff. That's mcremo.com. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Good night.